Okay, while you're doing that and applauding the speaker, I will give him a couple of seconds to get out of the stand. Anatol Levin.
Thank you very much, Mick. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you all for coming. It's an honour, as always, to be at the LSE. I could say I come to praise the Cold War, but not, I hope, to revive it. I will not carry out a revival meeting for the Cold War. I do think, however, that America would be well advised to learn some lessons from the Cold War and its eventual success in the Cold War, but also its numerous catastrophic failures in the course of that struggle. As we all know, the American state system as a whole was profoundly shaped by the Cold War, coming on top of the Second World War. The Bush foreign and security team were really, to a man and a woman, created by the Cold War, by Cold War structures. There's a very good book on this subject by James Mann called The Vulcans. And the Bush dynasty itself, though not a creation of the Cold War, was at least very, very much fostered by the Cold War struggle and by America's responses to it. It's important to note, however, I think, that the great military, security, economic structures of Cold War America grew up on top of an American political tradition and American political institutions, which had always been, in principle, extremely hostile to this kind of creation of massive military and military bureaucratic institutions. Of course, the American independence grew in part out of a hostility to standing armies. And throughout American history, really all the way up to the Cold War, this strong hostility to entrenched military structures remains. I mean, people who blame America too much for getting into the Cold War with the Soviet Union do tend to forget that after the Second World War, there was a demilitarization of American society, a demobilization of the American armed forces, which was described by General Marshall, not a man given to wild or hysterical exaggerations, as not a demobilization, but a rout. And that, in fact, when the Korean War came along, the American military was extremely badly prepared for that. In some ways, I think, although this is a subject which would need, obviously, far more investigation, a certain disconnect between American state structures and traditions, which are very, very old. One often forgets that in Europe. In many ways, American state institutions are the oldest in the world. They have changed less since their inception in the American Constitution and the beginnings of the American state than almost any other state, or indeed any other state, I would say, in the developed world. And it could be that the joining to these institutions of military security structures, which are in some sense alien to them, could explain some, at least, of the profoundly dysfunctional aspects of the top of the American political and administrative system that we have seen under George Bush, in which all established lines of command appear often to have gone haywire and to have been subverted and overtaken by small cliques, in a way almost reminiscent, not of the history of the American or any other republic, but more of dysfunctional European monarchies of the past. Now, when it comes to the legacy of the Cold War, I must say that, speaking as a historian, amongst other things, I often feel a kind of despair, almost. Because while, on the one hand, as I say, the American system was profoundly shaped by the Cold War, and hence its responses to 9/11, its strategy in the War on Terror, and its global strategy more widely today, are all shaped by the Cold War. And while parallels to the Cold War are made very, very frequently in the media, in a variety of lobby groups, by academics, and of course by representatives of the Bush administration itself, in fact, it seems to me that the real lessons have been very largely and almost to some degree deliberately unlearned. And that leads to a situation where, in some regards, policymakers and would-be policymakers, I must say Democrat as well as Republican, sometimes do seem determined actually to repeat the worst mistakes of the Cold War. More than that, where lessons are ostensibly learned, that they are often almost tragicomically inappropriate. Now, the single most important and damaging effect of America's Cold War structures on American policy, not just since 9/11, but also before, indeed very strongly before, is, I would say, the fact that they do depend for their existence on the existence, or at least the perceived existence, of enemy states and states as enemies. This is necessary to justify the continuation of the structures left over from the Cold War in anything like their Cold War size, in anything like their Cold War funding, and in anything like their way of approaching the world, something which affects not just the structures themselves, but also what is expected of the individuals within them. These structures, and to a great extent these individuals as well, were calibrated to conduct the Cold War against the Soviet superpower and its state allies. Now, other aspects, of course, of the Cold War did exist, but they have been to a great extent forgotten. And despite ample warnings in the course of the 1990s of the growth of Islamist terrorism by al-Qaeda and other groups, direct attacks on the US itself, let alone on US targets abroad, as has very often been noted, including by the 9/11 report, in a sharper form by people like Richard Clark and Paul O'Neill, despite these warnings, the American security structures, the American state as a whole, was extremely poorly prepared for an attack on the scale of 9/11 and very poorly prepared to fight against it. And I do think that that is to a very great extent because, as I've said, they were designed for armed rivalry with major states and not really to pursue and combat extremist terrorist movements hidden in largely or partially hostile populations possessing political cultures and social cultures extremely alien to those of the United States. And I have to say from that point of view, I've mentioned the effect on individuals of all this, not just structures, that I think the Cold War cultivated, at least on the analytical side, and in my world of what might be called the para-bureaucracy of those sections of American academia concerned with policy making, a spirit in which, after all, very many people were not allowed to go to communist countries for security reasons. And certainly, at least in the case of the Soviet Union, China, one or two other places, if they did go, of course, their ability to do serious research on the ground, you know, to penetrate into Soviet society, was extremely limited. And this cultivated, I think, a culture in sections of American para-bureaucracy or para-academia, in which, frankly, it was perfectly all right to sit behind a desk in Washington or somewhere and prate about countries that you had never visited and societies which you really did not understand. And you felt actually no need, and in some cases, I've said, you were not even allowed to go to the countries concerned. Now, in the context of the War on Terror, that has been extremely damaging because, of course, to it has been joined something which many more aware members, both of Western officialdom, but also of Western academic communities, are extremely worried about, which is the effect of a mixture of course, the genuine terrorist threat to Western targets abroad, but coupled, shall we say, with a certain degree of excessive bureaucratic caution, has led to far too many Westerners, academics as well as diplomats, being forced into compounds or bunkers. And I've seen this most clearly in the case of Pakistan. You know, warning after warning that you can't travel, that it's becoming increasingly dangerous, some of which is true, but some of which I think is exaggerated. And coming on top of the Cold War, that means that there is an absolutely critical lack in Washington, frankly, of people who actually know, seriously know, different parts of the Muslim world. But, I mean, that's something of an aside. They're not, I believe, an unimportant one. But I think much more important is the fact that after the end of the Cold War, while certainly, you know, there were leaders, there were groups in America who did make a serious attempt at a kind of demobilization, there were very powerful other groups who frankly did everything in their power either to keep the Cold War with Russia going, I mean to turn Russia into a substitute for the Soviet Union, or to create a new war with China, I mean abandoning the policy of the previous generation of reconciliation with China and trying to turn China into a new Cold War enemy. I don't want to be too cynical or materialist about it. I don't think that was simply in a direct or certainly not in a conscious sense a response to the threat of these people's, you know, incomes or status. But I certainly think that it was the effect of American Cold War structures which had, if you like, to a great extent been orphaned as a result of the end of the Cold War and couldn't think of quite what to do next. And so you have this business of, you know, swimming around trying to find new major roles which didn't really fit them. Certainly in the case of Russia, I mean, I went to Washington for the first time to join the U.S. Institute of Peace as a visiting fellow in 1996, and I came straight out of reporting the first Chechen War for the Times. The first Chechen War, which, as we know, the Russian army lost, and it lost it because of its profound decline and disintegration in the early 90s as a result of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the disintegration of the armed forces themselves. It's catastrophic decline in terms of morale, of funding, of the maintenance of equipment, of discipline, of command, and everything else. And it was beaten by a bunch of highly motivated but not at all numerous Chechen guerrillas. I arrive in Washington, and I am frankly astonished by what I find people writing and saying about Russia. Russia still forming a serious military threat, not just to Poland, but to Germany. Russia continually on the point of invading the Baltic states. Russia wishing to take over Central Asia militarily, Russia still being a military threat to Turkey, and so forth and so on. And incredible statements, frankly, emanating from people who claimed to be serious students of military history, amongst other things, about how the crisis of the Russian military could be reversed in a week, you know, if a strong man emerged and put it all together again. And really, this went on as long as it possibly could. I mean, and is still going to an extent today in some circles. In the case of China, we saw the Wen Houli scandal, which you may remember in the last years of Clinton, really whipped up in, to a very great extent, McCarthyite terms in an effort, and this was said quite explicitly, not just by Republicans, but by sections of the American media, you know, to create an image of an almost existential Chinese threat to American security carried out by, frankly, Chinese immigrants, you know, Chinese within America, who were accused in one statement as, you know, actually every single one of them was supposed to be a potential spy. And you had statements out of Congress, the Cox Report, you may remember, from Christopher Cox, and others, Gene Fitzpatrick, saying that the Chinese were on the, you know, had emerged as, you know, an existential threat to the United States. You know, once again, wildly exaggerated stuff. And this was, of course, reflected very much in the rhetoric of the Bush administration when it came to power in its first 8 months, but also, of course, in the vast majority of the language of the neoconservatives in their approaches to foreign and security policy in the late 1990s. They have chosen, of course, to forget this, but if you actually read their books at that time, terrorism is way, way, way down on their list of priorities. It's Russia. It's China. I mean, to some extent, of course, it is Muslim countries, but it's Iran, you know, it's Syria. It's not terrorism as such. And, as I say, the effects of this on the American system were very profound. Another legacy of the Cold War, of course, was the politicization of intelligence. At the most charitable a tradition in widespread circles of the American intelligence community of, shall we say, if such a thing can exist, engaging in a kind of hysterical prudentialism. In other words, taking the absolute maximum estimates for Soviet or Chinese military strength and treating them as if they were established, coupled, of course, with the very selective use of leaks often to political opponents of the US administration in power, with a view from the point of view of the intelligence people to strengthening a case for particular lines, and of course from the point of view of the opposition, undermining the government in power. Something, of course, during the Cold War, which both the Democrats and the Republicans did to each other, depending who was in power and who was in opposition. One should not forget that the classic example of this, the missile gap scare, was, of course, a Democrat scare against the Eisenhower administration and against the Nixon candidacy of 1960. And this legacy, I think, we've seen very strongly, I think pretty obviously, in the use of intelligence before the Iraq War. Even after 9/11, however, as has once again been widely noted by many expert critics in the United States, the bias towards dealing with genuinely or allegedly hostile states has continued, and does, in my view, at least in part, explain this otherwise truly extraordinary move, the rapidity of the move from the conquest of Afghanistan, from the pursuit of Al-Qaeda, to the beginning of plans for war with Iraq. The deep discomfort noted once again by people like Paul O'Neill, also by the senior CIA analyst who's written on imperial hubris under an anonymous cover, but the deep discomfort they seem to find in dealing with the nature of the terrorist and the Islamist extremist threat, as opposed to confronting states which, in reality or in their imagination, threaten America or may back the terrorist movements. Now, however, in this regard, there is something else which it's critical to note, I think. It's been widely suggested, on the left particularly, of course, in Europe, that if Bush wins the next elections, then he will follow the full neoconservative program and move, say, towards full-scale war with Iran, or possibly even other states. I think this is mistaken, myself. Indeed, I have to say that, deeply unhappy though I have been with this administration, I do think that in certain important respects it is quite possible, not in all, but in certain important respects it's quite possible that the foreign policy of a Bush administration would not in fact differ enormously from that of a Kerry administration. Now, the reason obviously has to do with the disastrous lesson of the Iraq War. But I think it also has to do with the nature of the American system inherited from the Cold War. C. Van Woodward had a very nice phrase about the American people. As a whole, he said that they were bellicose, but not militarist. In other words, they're willing to fight if America is attacked or even insulted, certainly more willing to fight than other nations at present in the developed world, but they do not believe in the militarization of society as a whole for the purposes of waging war. That is, as I've said, quite alien to the American historical tradition up to the Cold War. On the other hand, you could say of America's Cold War governing structures, Eisenhower's original phrase, I believe, was, by the way, not the military-industrial complex, but the military-industrial academic complex, which means us, if you please. Well, not all of us. But I would say of these governing structures, on the other hand, that they could be described as militarist, but not bellicose. They do believe in the militarization of the American state. They more or less have to preserve their own existence. And as I've said, this requires belief in the existence of hostile states. It does not, however, by any means necessarily mean a desire for actual war with these states. The American system is not a Mogul or a Napoleonic one. which actually depends, in a sense, for its existence, on continual victorious war to generate rewards for its leading members and their followers. On the contrary, in critical respects, it is threatened by serious war. Now, there are Napoleonic elements in America among the neoconservatives. I have no actual proof of this, but I strongly believe, you know, that places like the American Enterprise Institute and the Heritage, you know, when 6 o'clock comes and all the normal elements, you know, the secretaries and so forth, go home, they basically pull the curtains and they all go around in hats with, you know, their hands stuck into their jackets. I think there is good circumstantial evidence to support this.
That's the LSEIR department you're describing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's what we do.
Oh,
every,
well, it's more widespread than I'd thought. But their influence certainly has diminished. And equally important, and of course this is another clear contrast with the Napoleonic system, is that these people are militarists who have never served in the military. As we all know, only two senior members of the Bush administration have served in the military in war. They are, of course, General Powell and former Colonel Armitage, one of the most highly decorated soldiers in the American Army, of course. And these are also, as we know, the relative doves within the American administration. Certainly the neocons in particular are now hated and despised by much of the American uniform military. Not so much the Air Force and the Navy, of course, because they don't have to fight in Fallujah, but the Army and the Marine Corps, absolutely. And the American military, the uniform military, is certainly not a Napoleonic force. It is, in fact, a very cautious force in American foreign and security policy today, to the extent, from what I gather, that if the Bush administration or any administration were to go mad and actually plan a war of choice with Iran, they would actually face a mass of high-level resignations from the uniform military. And that's true, you know, of the wider structures which are linked to the military in many respects. I think that's true for a variety of reasons. Firstly, the American military-industrial complex, you know, into which, of course, so many of the senior officers go when they retire, going to a kind of financial heaven compared to their military salaries. It is part of the American capitalist system, and although it would benefit in some respects from war, and has benefited from small wars, it is certainly hostile to a major war which would destabilize and undermine the world capitalist system as a whole. Secondly, the Cold War was, of course, a struggle in which all serious members of the American security elites, at least over time, came to realize that a war with the main adversary would almost certainly mean the end not just of the United States, but of civilization itself. There were military confrontations, of course, with Soviet surrogates, and I'm not saying that certainly that the US military is hostile to small wars, small victorious wars, like Afghanistan, say. But it's also very, very generally recognized now within the uniform military, though not necessarily, of course, among American veterans, that of the two major conflicts which took place during the Cold War, Korea and Vietnam, only the first was truly necessary in the terms of the Cold War itself. The second was unnecessary and generally disastrous. So I think that... And finally, of course, there is the critical thing of all stemming from the lessons of the Vietnam War, which is the profound hostility of the American public as a whole, of American society, or at least of extremely extensive and powerful bits of it, to conscription. I mean, once again, this is not a militarist society. And knowledge now, not just in the uniform military, but really throughout the American state system, that if they get involved in another major war of occupation, then they will have to introduce conscription. They just do not have the professional troops or reserves to run another war like that. If they reintroduce the draft, then even some of the madder neoconservatives, I think, can see the end of the American empire actually down the line. Because, of course, then you really get large numbers of Americans asking about a variety of American commitments in the outside world. And for the first time, I think, you would get large numbers of Americans asking about the whole context and terms of the American presence in the Middle East and American commitment to the Middle East, both in terms of Israel but also of dependence on oil. So I think from that point of view, perhaps we could worry too much about what the Bush administration will do. And its resulting caution and pragmatism has, of course, been seen in the Bush administration's policies towards the Far East, towards China and North Korea in the past couple of years. Because once again, let's remember, I mean, they came to power with a really savagely anti-Chinese approach, at least if you read the rhetoric of John Bolton before he joined the administration and to some extent afterwards. And of course, with North Korea, it was all about intense pressure up to and including possible war. But ever since 9/11, they've really been trying to shed by far the greater part of this as far as China is concerned, and trying also to a considerable extent to dig themselves out of the hole in which their previous rhetoric concerning North Korea put them. Now, I'm not saying, alas, that a war between America and China over Taiwan is impossible in the years to come. It is possible. But it will be the effect, if God forbid it happens, of actions on the part of Taiwan itself, leading to reactions in Beijing and then American involvement. It won't be the conscious product of a desire for war in Washington, or indeed in Beijing itself, I think, which is why I think there's a very, very good chance that it won't happen. In the Middle East, things look rather different. One can't be so confident about the unlikelihood of war with Iran. Once again, not because they're going to plan an invasion of Iran the way there's an invasion of Iraq, but because there certainly is a possibility, not I would say a probability, but only a possibility, of either American or Israeli airstrikes or missile strikes against Iran's nuclear facilities. Especially that the Israelis might insist on this and the Americans give them a green light. And then, of course, I needn't tell you how easy it is to imagine a spiral of actions and reactions on the part of Tehran in Iraq, amongst other places in Afghanistan, which could ultimately lead to full-scale war. But above all, it seems to me that unlike in the Far East, where the Bush administration has in fact been pursuing a not unsuccessful diplomatic strategy, in the Middle East, it seems to me, they basically have no serious diplomatic strategy at all. Nor indeed, and this is what I mean about the unlearned lessons of the Cold War, beyond a certain promotion of free trade, really so far only with the smaller countries of the Middle East, at least those are the only places it's been successful with, Morocco, Jordan, Bahrain, and so forth. But beyond that, they have nothing like the strategies for the economic development of these states, which they had not just in Europe after the Second World War, because I think the Marshall Plan is actually not an appropriate model, but which they had, for example, with regard to South Korea and Taiwan and Japan during and after the Korean War, and which they had with Malaysia, Thailand, and other countries during the Vietnam War. And now, although, as I say, they may stumble into another war, they don't even really have a serious military strategy in the Middle East either, because of the very widespread lack of belief, once again, that they could actually do an Iraq again. That, you know, it is widely seen that they do not have the troops for this, and that the strain on American society would be too great. And so what you see instead is this attempt to promote democratization itself. I mean, admittedly now they've had to accept, you know, a slow and incremental process of democratization embodied in the Greater Middle East Initiative. This has emerged basically as a substitute for everything else, for all the wider strategies which they pursued during the Cold War, and of course as a substitute for a serious pursuit of Israeli-Palestinian peace as well. I mean, not only a substitute, but I would say to a certain extent a conscious diversionary tactic. Now, don't get me wrong, it's not obviously that I am against the promotion of democracy in the Middle East as such, but I am against, as I say, using this as a substitute for everything else. And I am against something which underlies this to some extent, and which really does replicate the catastrophic error, or errors, of the United States in the first 20 or so years of the Cold War, which was, however, then corrected to some extent in the last 20 years or so. And that is the homogenization of the enemy. The inability, or even to some degree the willful refusal for a long time, to recognize the deep divisions within the communist world, if you can call it a world, itself. The myths of a united communist threat to America and to the West, which continued to dominate American political thinking and the American political debate, long after it should have become manifestly apparent that this was no longer the case. So really to a considerable extent they got into Vietnam, a conflict which would have been really, I think, manifestly unnecessary if the American political elites could have recognized the role of nationalism in Vietnamese communism, the growing Sino-Soviet split, the differences, or at least very probable differences in future, between the Vietnamese communists and the Chinese communists, and so forth. And so you had the tragicomic spectacle in the late 1960s of American soldiers dying in their thousands, of Vietnamese dying in their hundreds of thousands, at a moment when the two great communist powers, the Soviet Union and China, were themselves fighting each other in eastern Siberia. And that, of course, was then corrected by the Nixon's and Kissinger's opening to China, their move to Beijing to balance China against the Soviet Union. But once again, they didn't get round to this until 40,000 American soldiers had died. We must hope that it won't be so in Iraq, although I see little prospect as yet for a change in policy. Because up to now, of course, what we've seen on the part of the Bush administration, but also, unfortunately, quite influential sections of American academia and the think tank world, is precisely an absolutely wanton, deliberate attempt to homogenize, to cram together every different kind of rival or critic of the United States and Israel in the Muslim world into one box. I mean, plus, of course, in the axis of evil, you create that box and then you throw the North Koreans in as well. Although, from what I gather, they may have been there really only to try and show that this wasn't an anti-Muslim box, you know, that anybody could join. Anybody can be evil, you know, including Brits, by the way, if anyone... but, you know, the lumping together of different elements in the Muslim world, who are, of course, as I think we all know, or at least anybody sensible does... I mean, certainly to some degree, but to very, very, very different degrees, hostile to the United States, but are also, of course, bitterly, bitterly hostile to each other. Namely, secular Arab nationalism, or even, if you like, fascism, as represented by the Ba'ath, Shiism, with Iran as its chief representative and geopolitical element, and the Sunni Islamist and extremist world of Al-Qaeda and its allies. In this attempt to turn these into a united enemy and treat them accordingly, I think we have seen a repeat of some of the worst aspects of the first 20 years of the Cold War. And in academic and intellectual approaches, this has been backed up by this idea which many of you may have encountered, put out by people on the left, or liberals like Paul Berman, on the right by people like Daniel Pipes, this idea of Islamo-fascism, which supposedly unites these radically different elements. As I told Berman in a debate in the summer, you know, something which suggests that, conservative supporters of the papacy and early Marxist socialists really formed one camp because they were equally hostile to bourgeois liberalism. You know, I really do think that this idea of Islamofascism is possibly one of the most historically illiterate, intellectually irresponsible, and politically disastrous ideas ever to have emanated, from the American or I couldn't say Western academia, because of course we in Europe cannot be rivaled, historically speaking, from that point of view, but certainly from America. And I mean, And then the attempt is made, and this once again brings back the links to the Cold War, the attempt is made by people like Paul Berman and Daniel Pipes to suggest that this Islamofascism. I mean, once again, Shia revolutionism in Iran, as well as Al-Qaeda and the Ba'ath, are somehow directly linked to and derived from the history of totalitarianism in Europe, fascist as well as communist. And therefore that the American struggle against this alleged monolithic enemy should be seen as a continuation of America's 20th century struggles against Nazism and communism, and should be conducted, you know, in the same terms as if this Islamofascism was just Soviet communism. I mean, of course, one should note that in the case of the Ba'ath, that's entirely true. I mean, there was, of course, a direct fascist influence. The Ba'ath boasted of it. But in the other two cases, as far as I can see, it's absolute historical nonsense. And out of this potpourri of intellectual delusion and confusion comes another Cold War analogy, often used in Washington official circles and in the intellectual debate in the media, despite fervent efforts, I may add, by European diplomats to suppress this, which is the suggestion that this Greater Middle East initiative somehow can reflect a successful parallel with the Helsinki process in Europe in the late 70s and the 80s, and the role of the Helsinki process in undermining Soviet rule, first over Eastern Europe and then over large parts of the Soviet Union itself, by spreading the space of freedom, support for freedom, and so forth and so on. Well, of course, this idea completely forgets two things from the Cold War. One is that in its absolutization, if you like, and idealization of freedom and democracy as such, it forgets the immensely strong role of nationalism in Eastern Europe and in much of the Soviet Union, of nationalist opposition to Soviet rule and what was perceived at least as Russian rule, and the role of this nationalism in backing up, in other words, a desire for the spread of democracy, which worked in Central Europe, manifestly did not work in large parts of the former Soviet Union. In other words, freedom is not enough. Secondly, of course, it does miss one little point, which almost nobody mentions in America. Nobody can mention outside the left, because it's just, I mean, unacceptable, unthinkable, almost literally unthinkable. But which is, if you would ask most ordinary Arabs and Muslims what country in the world they would now see as playing a role in the Middle East, somewhat at least analogous to that of the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe in the past, what do you think they'd say? That's right, they would say the United States of America. But believe me, that is not something you want to say in policy circles in Washington if you want to be invited back. Just to conclude, of course, in all this, there is an element which was not present in the Cold War, in anything like this central form, and that is, of course, the role of Israel and the Israeli lobby, both in catalyzing older and wider Muslim resentments, which, of course, originally had nothing to do with Israel, but certainly it has contributed to going on keeping these resentments alive, giving them a focus. But secondly, of course, as we see from incidents like the Syria Accountability Act, passed by Congress under heavy pressure from the Israel lobby, the critical role of that lobby in preventing the kind of opening to Tehran and to Damascus, which Nixon and Kissinger conducted towards China. In other words, the classic Cold War strategy of trying to split the enemy. Because it's also, of course, I mean, that's at the diplomatic level, geopolitical level. But clearly, one can't deny, I think, reasonably, that the effects of Israel's role and of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict on Arab and Muslim attitudes also does make it much more difficult even to conceptualize, let alone to conduct, the other aspect of the Cold War, which was, of course, very important, which was the ideological struggle, the battle of ideas, the battle of influence within societies against the communist threat, against the appeal of communism, which we, of course, now need to do in the struggle, at least against Sunni Islamist extremism. Because, as this CIA analyst who I mentioned in Imperial Hubris wrote, Al-Qaeda really has two agendas, Al-Qaeda and its allies, because, as you well know, it's a grave mistake to see Al-Qaeda simply as representing the world of Sunni extremism. One, once again, with certain parallels to communism, is a socially and culturally revolutionary program for the radical transformation of Muslim societies themselves and Muslim states, and the elimination, to a very great extent, of their existing elites. And the, you know, as we saw in Afghanistan, as we saw in Iran in its radical phase, I mean, this is a truly revolutionary program, with, by the way, economic implications as well. That program does not actually have enormous support in the Muslim world. It has support, certainly, but in its truly radical, if you like, sort of, you know, truly revolutionary form, it certainly doesn't have very general support. I mean, simply because it does involve turning societies upside down. In the case of Afghanistan, for example, the Afghan cities, or Pakistan, if they could do it, it would prevent people watching Bollywood movies. I mean, truly a revolutionary step and highly unpopular. There is, however, the second part of the program of Al-Qaeda and its allies, which is the geopolitical one. Drive America out of the Middle East and humble or even destroy Israel. And unfortunately, I mean, that geopolitical program is one which has very widespread support in the region. So just to conclude, and once again, I mean, that the US is finding it extremely difficult to combat at the level of ideas. Well, does this mean that in the Middle East and the war on terror, rather than repeating its success in the Cold War, the US may in fact be fated to repeat the existence of the Soviet Union, and that American hegemony in the Middle East will in fact collapse? I think that at the moment, at least, that would be both too pessimistic and too deterministic. But what I do think it means is that America, as of today, once again, not just the Republicans, but also the Democrats, is, to an extent that was not true in the last 20 years of the Cold War, to a very great extent crippled in its ability to design the kind of ruthless, but also often intelligent, flexible, and effective strategies which in the end helped to bring America victory in the Cold War. And at best, this may mean some years at least to come of the United States, and by implication Britain as well, essentially fiddling around the edges of the major challenges which we face from the Muslim world. At worst, it means that the American system is basically sitting waiting around for another disaster to happen. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Anatole. I'll allow those who are leaving to leave. And we don't want to wait too long for Q&A. So I have a team of deadly people carrying microphones. Could you wave your microphone in the air? Here's a microphone man here, and there's a microphone man there. So, right, please, thank you. I'll just wait for the others to go. I'll take two on this side first. There's a gentleman here with glasses on. There's a gentleman here with a blue hat on. Yeah. Okay, guys, if you could just if you go out quietly, please. Thank you. If you could speak up very, very loud.
You referred to the mistakes during the Cold War, the war with Vietnam, and you obviously referred to the cost to America. And, of course, we know much larger cost to Vietnam, the hundreds of thousands killed and devastation still continuing. As a parallel, if the delay continues in the correction to US policy, do you see a nightmare scenario for the Middle East? I mean, the further devastation, I mean, of Iraq or Palestine and possibly other countries. What are the costs to the world from that point of view? I mean, not just the West. Thank you.
Okay, I'll take another one here, Anatole. There's plenty of hands going up. I'll get everybody. It's okay. I've got good eyes. Bad sense of humor, but good eyes. Yeah,
hi.
Please.
Just curious. What should America do about Israel?
Okay, that's a simple question. if you can answer that question, anyway. Anatole, two very simple questions, one on Vietnam and the impossible question to which you have a clear answer. Mm. What should America do about Israel?
Well, of course, I mean, where the parallel to Vietnam does not work is precisely that when America did pull out of Vietnam, and that is, of course, the tragedy of everybody who died there, it seemed that it really wasn't necessary, even in the most brutal realpolitik terms, on which that war was fought. They balanced China, and it must be said rather disgustingly, Cambodia against Vietnam. But then, even if they hadn't had Cambodia, they would have had Thailand. But similarly, or rather unsimilarly, Vietnam itself, of course, came under the rule of an extremely effective, very disciplined, united political force which built a communist state, which did not, in fact, as it turned out, export destabilization or revolution, let alone terrorism, or at least it had, and had no ambition to do so beyond Indochina itself. And had it done so, would once again have been checked, not only by us, but by China as well. Now, of course, the parallel with Iraq doesn't work there, because there is no such force in Iraq which could take over that whole country and run it, and with which one could then do a deal. Because, of course, actually, America could have done a deal with the Viet Cong pretty soon after pulling out of that country, which would have stuck. I mean, they couldn't for a whole set of obvious reasons. But if they had, the deal would have stuck. Iraq, of course, looks very different. And to me, I must say, this is the fundamental catastrophe and sin of the whole war. They have created a situation in which almost any outcome is destabilizing and will lead to greater problems elsewhere and will involve increased threats of terrorism and destabilization. I must say, I mean, this may be just a sort of cynical imperial historian speaking, but I have a nasty feeling that what it will come down to in the end, and there is talk of this in private in Washington, is basically just arming Shia and Kurdish militias, stitching up some kind of deal with Sadr and the Shia radicals, if they can, and then just turning those militias loose on the Sunni areas of the country if they won't submit. I mean, I don't know that it will come to that, but I have a strong suspicion. But that, of course, it won't end terrorism. It will have a very bad effect on Sunni Arab populations elsewhere in the region. And I think in the long run, it will be very costly to the world. But also, I would say that even to have a good chance of adopting that kind of cynical imperial approach, it would at least be enormously facilitated by an opening to Tehran and to Damascus, something which, of course, Europe is tremendously interested in as well, but which so far has just been completely blocked in Washington. What should America do about Israel? Well, I don't think that America should do anything about Israel at all. Israel exists. It has the right to exist. It has every right to exist, as I've always said, within the borders of 1967, and any adjustments to that which can be agreed with the Palestinians and then legitimized by the international community. Within those parameters, I don't think America should do anything about Israel except go on supporting it. Beyond that, however, put it this way, at least until this US administration, every US administration had the official line that the Israeli settlement policy beyond the borders of 1967 was both illegal and destabilizing and extremely harmful to the peace, to any prospect of peace, with the Palestinians and with the Arab world. Problem was, of course, they never did anything about it. The support for Israel continued. Now, of course, this administration has gone one stage beyond that and has actually called the whole, the principled opposition to the settlements into question. But I do think that if America wants to be minimally consistent with the ideals which are being, you know, preached or promoted in the greater Middle East by this, you know, Middle East initiative, by the democratization program. I mean, if it wants that, and if therefore it is seriously interested in a battle for hearts and minds in the Muslim world, then it just cannot afford to continue its alliance with Israel on the present terms. I'm not against the alliance with Israel per se at all, but the terms have to change. I also believe, I must say, that if they don't change, at some stage America is going to have to choose between an alliance with Israel and an alliance with Britain. I can't see Britain in the very long run continually and indefinitely sacrificing its own security interests for those of what is frankly an extremely misguided American policy. Do I think, however, that American policies are going to change? Well, look at the American presidential debate, where this whole issue was hardly mentioned, let alone debated. So, I mean, my fear is, you know, not only that this will continue, but that, as I say, it has a tremendous knock-on effect via the power of the Israel lobby on America's ability to pursue serious détente with Iran and with Syria. In which, by the way, I am certainly not saying that America should just, you know, throw up its hands and agree to everything that Tehran wants and ignore, you know, Iran's role in supporting Hamas and agree to Iranian nuclear weapons. No, I'm saying basically what the British government says. I'm also, by the way, not. I would say very strongly that Europe, you know, must be prepared to threaten stronger economic sanctions against Iran. But equally, I mean, once again, I'm just saying what British, European diplomats, strong supporters of the alliance with America, say. I mean, if America wants that to work, and if America wants European countries to support such a move, then America has to be prepared to offer serious détente and concessions on the other side.
Okay, I've got a lot of hands going up.
Sorry.
I don't want to discriminate against the balcony. I'll take this gentleman here, and there was another question over here at the back. Have you got... Yeah. Please brief with your questions, please. My friend here. Mohammed, yeah. Yeah, you. Please.
A few questions came to my mind.
We'll just make one, Mohammed.
Okay.
My friend.
It's okay. You know each other.
How do you see America's exit from Iraq and how this will be reflected on its position in the Middle East in general and its supposed leadership of the free world?
Okay, that's a good question. I'll take one other question over here, and then I'll go upstairs because I don't want to be, what do they call it, balconist. Yeah.
Supposing the Democratic challenger in the States proves victorious in this coming election, do you see any change in the future of the Cold War era structures that you previously spoke to in the absence of, say, more catastrophic events? And what time frame would, in the case that this does occur, do you see, do you predict normative change? And of what sort?
Right. Two questions.
If
you could deal with them.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, these structures will change over time. I mean, perhaps laid it on a bit thick. One does see, obviously, responses to the terrorist threat. The intelligence community, in particular, is being radically recalibrated, although, as I think everyone who knows that community is well aware, I mean, much more slowly than is desirable, and with tremendous institutional opposition to change. Nonetheless, over time, one can hardly imagine Cold War structures remaining as they are now for decades to come, particularly, of course, God forbid, if there are more major terrorist attacks. I think, however, that the changes will come, you know, as a result, as people in the Soviet Union say, of life itself, rather than of a radically different approach, frankly, by a Kerry administration to these questions. I think myself that the Kerry administration will make a considerable difference in domestic policy in America. Not a difference on the scale of the New Deal or a radical transformation, but a very observable difference in a number of areas. And I think that will have a very good effect on US relations with Europe, by the way. But I mean, knowing the democratic foreign policy elites, I just can't see them aiming at a radical transformation of the structures they inherit. How will America exit, and what effect will this have? Well, if I knew how America could exit, I'd try and promote the idea. I don't know. I doubt myself that it will be anything quite like, you know, quite as radical as, you know, pulling out of Saigon with people hanging onto the helicopters.
The lucky ones.
The lucky ones. And that is, I mean, once again, to go back to this brutal imperialist logic, but as an American official said to me in private recently, look, if you want to look at us as an empire, as a kind of indirect empire in Iraq, we have one tremendous advantage over the British. They were basically trying to use 20% of the population to hold down 80%. In other words, the Sunni Arabs and to some extent, you know, the followers of the Hashemites who'd come in to hold down the Kurds and the Shia. We are ultimately trying to use 80% of the population to hold down 20%. That may not be any nicer, but it has a much greater chance of success. If, of course, you can do something once again about the Shia radicals, you know, about Sadr and company, that's where Tehran comes in again. But to some extent, as I said in my talk, I think the effect on the image of America in the world, some of it has already happened, in that people just don't believe that an American threat to invade and occupy more states is credible. Clearly, the more of a mess there is, the less credible future operations of this kind will become. But of course, also, I mean, a critical part of all this, which we can't really assess at the moment, is the effects on the domestic American political situation and attitudes if you get casualties at the present level going on for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years indefinitely. And you could have, to some extent, the whole Vietnam syndrome repeating itself. And Reagan's role in America was very largely to sweep Vietnam under the carpet. But if you... And undoubtedly people will try to do this, once again with failure in Iraq. But, you know, there are a limited number of things you can sweep under the carpet before it begins to look a bit lumpy. And I think the American, after two debacles like this, what Reagan presented as this smooth carpet of American myths about, you know, American peacefulness and benevolence and so forth, and inevitable victory, might begin to look seriously lumpy.
Okay, from up here, please. My friend Bryant playing there with the microphone. Ryan, up to you. Leave him alone. Bryant, go for it.
My question to you is, do you think that there's honestly anything that the United States could do to improve its relationship or image in the Middle East, or has the situation on the ground become so toxic, so hostile, that there really isn't anything that the U.S. could do, and that the best thing that it might do is step out of the way and make room for another more neutral observer to stand in, like the European Union or someone else?
And there was one at the back there.
Yeah.
I'll take one more in the middle, too, here.
My question goes a little bit further back in history. On the 12th of September 1939, there was a meeting between Council of Foreign Relations representatives and the State Department about how the world should look like after the war. I mean, that was less than 2 weeks after the Germans entered Poland. There was also, if one go back and read what the sentiments were in the Council of Foreign Relations and people surrounding that, a deep fear about what would happen after the war. And if one looks at the NSC 68, their National Security Council 68, and George Kennan, what he wrote, there was, after the war, a deep fear that the demand without the war demand would not satisfy the economy and that it would fall back into a depression state again. So the Truman administration was really afraid to get a demilitarization because of those reasons. So the Cold War came in quite handy to justify the spending for the military.
So the question, is...
The question is, this is something that has been very, very little covered.
Mm.
The same goes for the founding of the UN and a few other things. And I would like to hear the comments on why.
Okay. Sorry about these difficult questions. You know, they've all got two A levels. You know,
my question is a bit shorter. I would like to know how a nuclear Iran would change the current Middle East.
A
nuclear Iran would change the current rules of the game.
A nuclear Iran. We'll take one final from the gentleman at the back there, please. And I think we'll run these as a C, and then I think we'll...
Yeah, I have just a brief question. You spoke often of Cold War structures that the United States clings to, or that the major players in foreign policy have been born out of. And I was wondering, one, what specific Cold War structures you were thinking of. You never, CIA or the Defense Department. And two, if any of the reforms that have been currently put forward, do you think are a positive step in getting away from this kind of metastasized Cold War structure? That's my question.
There's four questions there. I think that'll take you about 5 minutes, and then we'll bring it to an end. Over to you, Anatole.
Well, first of all, I should say that I'm very grateful for some questions, at least from the left, because I don't often get them in Washington. And it allows me to say to my, it must be said, extremely sceptical colleagues that I represent a centrist position, whereas, as you can imagine, in Washington, that is not the general view. On that score, however, I should say that although, in what I said, I did, to a great extent, attribute many of the attitudes or the continuation of attitudes on the part of the American, whatever you want to call it, military, industrial, bureaucratic, academic complex, ultimately to conscious or unconscious material interests. I am not actually convinced. Now, I'm not an expert on that, the genesis of the Cold War as such, but I'm not convinced that it was launched by America in any straightforward way or consciously as a, out of an economic strategy or interest. I think the record of what was done, as I say, with the American military after 1945 does strongly go against that, which I mentioned. Now, that is not to say, that by any means America's responses, the late 1940s or early 1950s, were necessarily all correct or appropriate. George Kennan himself, as later decided that America had gone much too far and reacted in a much too undifferentiated way. I think Stalinism was a genuine threat in many ways to large parts of the world. I think America's behavior was, to a considerable extent, a reaction against that, albeit with all kinds of sort of little appendices, like trying to take over some of Britain's world role, which of course they did, and inherit bits of geopolitical advantage. When it comes to which Cold War structures, I can see, you can see some of it in all of them, except possibly the Marine Corps, which has always, had a rather, as people in the American establishment think, a slightly strange ideas of its own. But certainly you can see an American army calibrated tremendously still, despite valiant efforts to overcome this, including, by the way, ones on the part of Rumsfeld in some respects. But an American army which has certainly clung to the utmost to a desire to preserve some of the same structures of forces, the kinds of forces, the military spending, the weapons systems that they had during the Cold War. Now, I should say on that score that while much of what Rumsfeld proposed or achieved, has been greatly undermined by Iraq. The lack of sufficient troops, obviously. His fundamental desire for different kinds of forces has been correct. The kind of Cold War forces that the American army favoured were equally inappropriate to an Iraqi-style operation. In the case of the CIA, I mentioned some of the preoccupations, the preoccupations with states, the construction of intelligence, the, you know, the military, well, the military bean counting, you know, the counting of weapons, the counting of forces, into which strangely more and more beans seem to fall out of people's pockets and out of their sleeves, you know. And in my own world of think tanks, to a very great extent, one sees, you know, people who, at least a considerable number, who made intensive efforts in the 1990s to try and, you know, preserve their image of the world as it had been created. Now, you know, this is changing. I think the 9/11 Commission did make some very positive recommendations. You do have, obviously, I mean, some people in the think tanks. I mean, you heard John Mearsheimer, for example, you know, the great American students of international relations, members of the realist tradition, who are thinking in very new terms. But I'm afraid, I mean, just to return to perhaps a very materialist point, that there is a great hindrance, from the point of view of actually understanding what's going on in extensive bits of the Muslim world. I mean, the fact that the CIA is appallingly bad at HUMINT, you know, human intelligence, especially in the Muslim world, but even more widely, is now, you know, very generally recognized, including within that institution itself, but they don't know what to do about it. I mean, it is very difficult, of course, to find people who can do that successfully in the Muslim world. That is, after all, one of the central reasons why America and Britain have to have Muslim allies. We've got to have Muslim allies in this struggle against the Islamist extremist threat. But it is also because, you know, there is this, you know, in my own world where we, you know, after all, we're not spies, most of us. But if you like, considerations of comfort and safety are tremendously backed up by a tradition which, as I say, and it's not only the fault of the Cold War by any manner of means, I mean, the whole sort of theoretical approach to international relations, you know, rational choice theory and so forth, have a lot to answer for. But certainly there is not nearly the encouragement in my world that there should be for people actually to damn well get out there and study societies. Go and talk to people. Find out how they work. Find out what people think. There are far too many people, you know, even in institutions which are very well funded by British standards, far too many people sitting behind desks in Washington or New York or wherever, or in California, and, you know, at most going off to international conferences in Dubai or somewhere for 3 days. which is one way of saying that if I do go back to Afghanistan myself, I hope I get a bloody good bonus, although I'm sure I won't. What was I going to say? Is there anything that the US can do to improve its image in the Middle East? Well, of course, one should remember the Middle East, or the greater Middle East, is not just the Arab world. I mean, in the Arab world, it will be extremely difficult. I mean, I've suggested, that trying to bring about a just and stable settlement between Israel and Palestine would certainly be a help. But, you know, one must recognize that the depth of suspicion and anger is very great. But, of course, the Middle East, or certainly the Muslim world, extends far beyond the Arab world. As has often been said, one of the effects of, you know, the system that we see in Iran, and, of course, its relative openness and democracy, as well as, you know, combined with the continued theocratic clamp on the system and, to some extent, on culture, means that, as once again has so often been pointed out, the most pro-American bit of the entire Muslim world may well be Iranian youth. So there is actually a lot to play for there, I think, in terms of détente with Iran. Whereas, of course, if America or Israel, God forbid, bomb Iran, I mean, all that will go out of the window. I mean, I have clowns in Washington every now and again telling me, oh, that they've heard from journalists that, you know, they talk to kids in Tehran and they tell them, yes, you should bomb the mullahs. Believe me, it would not look like that if they actually did it. So there's something to play for in Iran. There is a tremendous amount to play for, at least to play against, in Pakistan, where, you know, the relationship with America is a very ambiguous one, because, of course, America so often during the Cold War was a sponsor of the Pakistani state, or certainly of the Pakistani military. Certain bonds still remain. certainly a pragmatic desire for some kind of American protection against India remains. And, I mean, I myself, as a specialist on South Asia, amongst other things, do think that one of the really almost criminal aspects of the desire to of the move on from Afghanistan to Iraq was the fact that although, I mean, America has done its best to promote better relations between Pakistan and India, it certainly has not thrown behind the Kashmiri peace process anything like the diplomatic weight and the political pressure and the economic and political incentives that it should have done. Because, you know, Pakistan is not going to collapse tomorrow, all this stuff about Islamist revolution in Pakistan and seizing nuclear weapons is utterly exaggerated and unreal, in my view, for the next 10 years, probably 20 years. On the other hand, if the arms race with India continues at its present level, and if a whole set of demographic, economic, social, and not least ecological indicators in Pakistan continue to go on as they have for the past 10 years or so, then the collapse of the Pakistani state, the failure of the state and of organized society in Pakistan, I think in 30 years or so, becomes very real indeed as a danger. So I think there are all kinds of things that America can do to improve its image in the wider Middle East. Unfortunately, I am just not catastrophically pessimistic, but not very optimistic that it's actually going to happen. Thank you.
Okay, I've got one comment. Well, like the Bush doctrine, you preempted me there just a little bit. President Bush said that there's no French word for entrepreneur. However, this is not true at the LSE. We're a book for $18.99 has got 20% discount outside, I'm told.
Yeah.
So there you go. And if you can work out what 20% of £18.99 is, you're much better than I, Gunga, did. Let me just say quickly about future activities. Of course, all the trouble started with Henry Kissinger. You all know that. And so, of course, the Cold War Center has a lecture on Henry Kissinger, would you believe? Such a coincidence, on the 2nd of November. Please go to our website to find out about that. That's going to be given by Professor Yussi Hanimaki from the University of Geneva. And then we got our own Fred Halliday on the 11th of November. Again, one more round of applause for Anatole for a great performance.